The trip down was one thing. The trip back was a whole nother story. We hit Charlotte, y'all. We hit Charlotte, North Carolina about 4 o'clock on Friday of the Friday before Christmas week. And the roads were just terrible. And after about an hour of crawling along, we stopped to eat at Bob Evans thinking we'd wait for the worst of the traffic to get by. Waited until about 6:30, got on the road, and they must all stopped at Bob Evans too because we got on, it wasn't any better than we got off. So we had planned on making it all the way back, end up stopping in Wytheville, Virginia for the night because it was still another 4.5, took us 5.5 hours to get home after that. So it was a long trek. Very tired when we got home, and glad we had at least the afternoon yesterday to kind of rest up a little bit, and had different family over to see Miranda. She's back, and if you can't spot her this morning, if you don't know which one she is, she's the one saying yes sir and yes ma'am all the time, sitting back there in the back row. So glad to have her back with us. We had a great time down there. It brought back a lot of memories, and I'm glad they're memories. And we're really excited about what we saw and what Miranda's accomplished. Mark chapter 14. No, that's my Sunday morning message. Wait a minute. See, you miss a few days and a preacher gets thrown all out of whack here. Luke chapter 23. Luke chapter 23. We're again looking at the events leading up to the crucifixion of Christ. Pilate has already had Christ before him once. And you remember, to get brownie points with Herod, he sent him off to Herod because Jesus was from Galilee, and that was Herod's jurisdiction. Pilate was trying to pass the buck. And so he sent him off to Herod. And one reason was also to smooth the ruffled feathers of Herod, because we saw last week that at one time previously, Pilate had killed some Galileans without Herod's knowledge of it, and so there was friction between Herod and Pilate. So Pilate now sent Christ to Herod to try to smooth those things over, and we found out that the two that were at enmity between each other before that were now friends over their mutual dislike of Christ. And so he sent him off to Herod, but then, like a hot potato, here he comes right back before Pilate again. And Pilate now is standing with Christ in front of him. We talked about how one of these days the tables will be turned. People today stand in judgment of Christ. You know, well, I don't believe in him. He's got to prove himself. I don't think he's all he claimed to be. People stand in judgment of Christ. One of these days it's all going to get turned around and we're all going to stand before him. So the best thing to do is not stand in judgment of him now, because that judgment will get turned around. That's why every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. But now Pilate is standing again for the second time with Christ in front of him, and he's going to offer the Jews a choice, and that's the topic of our lesson this morning. He's going to offer them a choice. It's going to take us the next 3 Sundays to actually cover all that happens when Christ is before Pilate this second time before he's delivered to be crucified. And this time is where Pilate actually gives to the Jews the choice of having one released to them at the Passover. And he says, you have a custom that I release unto you one at the Passover. He's trying to get himself out of a tough spot. And instead of making a command decision, instead of releasing the one he's already declared innocent to appease the people, he says, well, who do you think I should release? Hoping they would ask for Barabbas. And of course they don't. They say, not this one. Release Barabbas, crucify Christ. So we're going to look at that choice here this morning. This one part of this story is recorded in all 4 of the Gospels. And so you'll notice there's 4 points to our outline. We're going to look at a different Gospel account for each of the different things. So you've got all 4 of the references listed here. And again, the Bible is such an amazing book. You've got 4 Gospel accounts of the same event. Some of the information recorded is duplicated, it's the same, but then others give you, Matthew gives you things that Mark didn't say, Luke gives you things that John didn't say, and they all fit together perfectly to give us the whole story and all the information. If we're trying to gather all the information, we've got 4 gospel accounts to do it from. Those gospel accounts do not contradict. The Bible never contradicts itself. There are times where people think they've found a contradiction, only to find out they contradicted themselves by thinking there was a contradiction in the Bible. Because every contradiction in the Bible has an explanation. Now, we're not all smart enough to figure them out, and some of them we won't know until we get to heaven. But there is an explanation for every supposed contradiction in the Bible. Let's look this morning, first, letter A, at the declaration found here in Luke chapter 13. The declaration that Pilate makes. As soon as Pilate had Jesus returned to him by Herod, it says in verse number 13, that Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people, the first thing he wanted to do is let these rulers know, let these chief priests know, I found no fault in him. I sent him to Herod, who found no fault in him. Now I'm bringing him back again the third time to let you know there is no fault in him. There was no blemish. He's a lamb without spot and blemish. There was no fault in him. And so he's going to tell them that. Notice number one, the saying. And this is recorded in verse number 14. The saying. You have brought this man before you as one that perverteth the people, and behold, I, having examined him before you, have found no fault in this man. Then he says in verse 15, no, nor yet Herod. Those that stood face to face and toe to toe with Christ could find no fault in him. Somebody that lives 2,000 years later that goes back and says, I think there's something wrong with him, is a hypocrite. Because they're not taking the word of someone that saw him in person, looked him in the eyeballs, lived at the same time. They're coming 2,000 years later and saying, oh, the people that lived with him, that saw him and listened to him, couldn't find fault with him, but I can. That's the height of egotism. And that, again, we will one day stand in judgment before Christ, not the other way around. So he says, I found no fault in him, nor yet Herod. Small letter A. That was based on examination. Based on examination. Christ stood before Herod. Herod gave him many questions. Christ stood before Pilate. Pilate's going to ask him in this encounter many questions. And yet in everything that they examine him, they come with this conclusion. I mean, this is Pilate. These are Roman procurators. These are judges of the highest system of the legal Roman court system. If there was a flaw in a man, they could spot it in a heartbeat. They've had criminals stand before them for years and years. They've seen every case. They've seen every criminal. They know everything inside and out. They can spot people by their appearance. And yet, on examination of Christ, they said, I find no fault. See, folks, an honest examination of the facts concerning Jesus Christ will always lead someone to faith. An honest examination. The key word there is honest. An honest examination of all the facts surrounding Christ will lead someone to faith. There was a graduate student at University of Michigan named Josh McDowell. And Josh McDowell was not an atheist. It's not that he didn't believe there was a God, but he was an agnostic. And he'd heard these claims about Christ and the walking on the water and the miracles and saying he was the Son of God and all that. And he decided for his doctrinal dissertation that he was going to write it on the claims of Christ. He was going to debunk this. He was going to show that it was all, that there were holes in it. Nobody had ever been able to prove it conclusively. He was determined. He traveled to Israel. He went to Galilee. He saw all the spots. He did everything. He went to Egypt. He read the books. He did everything he could to make that doctrinal dissertation. You know what happened? He got saved. His examination, he wrote a book called Evidence That Demands a Verdict. It's about that big. And it's got all the footnotes, it's got all the evidence, it's got everything. No honest person can refute what he's written in that book. Because it's researched, it's well documented, it's footnoted. An honest examination will bring somebody to the facts. Now Josh McDowell's one of the greatest apologists in Christianity today. He's writing Evidence That Demands a Verdict. He's got all the kind of books on that stuff. But that's what happened. When you honestly look at the facts about Christ, it's going to draw you to him. Because there in him is no spot, in him is no blemish. You can't find any fault in him. So we find the saying based on examination. Number two, or small letter B, the saying with the declaration that he has no fault was also based on envy. on envy. Over in Matthew chapter 27, it's on the notes here, Pilate knew that for envy they had delivered him. See, Pilate wasn't real bright on religious issues. That wasn't his thing. I mean, you know, the Roman religion of any god and every god and all that kind of stuff. And he wasn't really up on the Jewish religion and the system and all that kind of stuff. But when it came to politics, he was an expert. When it came to politicians, he knew what he was. That was his game. And when he saw those chief priests and those Pharisees and those scribes gathered around, he knew this wasn't about religion. This was about popularity. This is about the fact that this man, Jesus, was attracting followers, and these other men, the Bible said, for envy they had delivered him. And he saw through the whole thing. We think we can dupe people so many times. You know, people are experts on stuff. The person you don't want to meet is that person that's an expert on interrogation that can read body language. They know that when your eyes move one way or the other, they know if you're telling the truth or lying. Those are the guys that ought to scare you to death. Because you're not going to, your body language, they've done it for so long they can read it. Well, imagine standing before a God that not only knows your body language, but can read the thoughts of your mind. And for envy they had delivered him. So Pilate says, I know what's going on here. I know he's innocent. You've delivered him for envy. I want you to know, I find no fault in him. That was the saying. Then notice, if you would, number two, the suffering. The suffering. Pilate says in verse 14, I find no fault in him. Verse 15, no, nor yet Herod, for I sent you to him, and lo, nothing worthy of death is done to him. But verse 16, I will therefore chastise him and release him. Now, something's rotten in Denmark. He's innocent. Herod said he's innocent. Pilate says he's innocent. And the job of a judge is to protect the innocent. But he says, I will therefore chastise him. On what grounds? For what reason? Why are you going to chastise somebody? You said, I found him to be innocent. Can you imagine that happened today and the news media found out about it? It'd be all over the news at 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock. But that's exactly what happened back then. They declared him innocent and yet chastised him. You say, well, how could that possibly happen? Well, again, the book of Isaiah said they bruised him. The Bible said he was led as a lamb before the slaughter. All these things have been prophesied that would happen to Christ. And though they weren't justified, they had been prophesied. And it's not, a lot of times folks have a hard time with the Old Testament. They read what these people did and they said, look what this guy did, and God approved of that. Wait a minute. It didn't say God approved of this. It said this guy did this. He took his concubine, cut her into 12 pieces, sent it to all the children of Israel. Somebody says, what kind of God is that? God didn't do that. The Israelite did that, and the Bible recorded that he did that. They bruised him. That doesn't mean it was right. They chastised him when he was innocent. The Bible's recording what happened, not saying this is right to do. It's not right to chastise somebody that's been declared innocent. And so Pilate's declaration, I have found no fault in him, and yet he turns around and punishes that one that he found no fault. Why? Well, to appease the people. The fear of man bringeth a snare. And Pilate, to appease the people, chastised Christ, thinking that would be enough. But you know, it wasn't enough. They were bloodthirsty. It wasn't going to be enough. He didn't get himself off the hook at all. So notice number two, letter B, if you would, and that is the dream. Go over to Matthew chapter 27. Matthew chapter 27. And we're going to look down at verse number 19, where right in the middle of all this that's going on, the Bible says in Matthew 27, verse 19, when he was sat down on the judgment seat, his wife sent unto him, saying, have thou nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him. So letter B is the dream. Matthew is the only one that tells us about this dream. So he interjects something into this story that Mark, Luke, and John don't tell us about. He tells us about this dream. Notice, if you would, number one, the person. When he was sat down on the judgment seat, his wife said unto him, "Have nothing to do with this just man, for I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him." Now, history tells us that his wife's name was Proda. Well, the question is, why did Proda have the dream and not Pilate? Why did God give a dream to Pilate's wife? Wouldn't it have been more to give Pilate the dream, you know, kind of like Nebuchadnezzar back in the Old Testament, back in Daniel? Give him the dream and let him trouble him. But see, God knows our makeup. God knows. He knew Pilate. And he knew if he gave that dream to Pilate, Pilate was so hard. Pilate was so tough. He'd been a Roman for so long. His heart was so hard that God said, "I'm not going to give him the dream. I'm going to give it to his wife. Someone that will soften him. Someone that will have an effect on him. Someone he loves about and cares for. I'm going to speak to him through her, because that's where he's most vulnerable." Aren't you glad God knows where we're vulnerable? We want to think that we're not. We want to put up the wall. We want to put up the facade. We want to show that. But God knows where we're vulnerable. And when he wants to speak to us, he's going to get that. He's going to walk that avenue, because he knows exactly how to get through us the best. He knows how stubborn we are, how rebellious we are, how hard-hearted and stiff-necked we can be. But he also knows the best way to try to speak to us. Now, the problem is, he can use the best way, and we can still say no. He can use the best avenue, because he knows what's the best way to speak to us, whether through a loved one, whether through some circumstance, whether through some job. I don't know what it is in individual lives. But here, God's trying to get a hold of Pilate's heart and speak to him. And he knows, if I speak to Pilate, he's just going to brush it off. If I give him the dream, but if I give it to her, she's going to go tell him, "Don't do this. Don't do this." She's going to warn him. I can trust her to warn him. And so she does. Number two, after the person, number one, and number two, is the pain. She says, "I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him." The pain. "I have suffered many things." It was a troubling dream. Like Nebuchadnezzar. Like Pharaoh. Like others in the Bible that had a dream that troubled them. But it was a divine dream. And God sent it to trouble her. You know what we learn from that? We learn that sometimes God sends troubles to get our attention. Now, God doesn't work through dreams and visions in our day like he did back then. A lot of times he goes through the Word of God. When we read our Bible every day, sometimes the things we read trouble us because they just don't jive with what we think. They just don't jive with how we feel about certain things. Or they show us ourselves the part that we're trying to cover up and forget about. But God has a way to show of showing us things that are going to trouble us. Now the response is, what are we going to do when we find out those things that trouble us? What are we going to do when we come face to face with personal failure or things that need to be shored up or strengthened up? What are we going to do with that? God will send us things to trouble us. God uses troubling, suffering to get attention. Sometimes he uses the pain to stop us from further trouble. Somebody say, "Why did this happen to me? It's a bad thing." Well, maybe this happened so that wouldn't. Maybe God allowed this suffering here so that it would slow us down or turn us back here so we don't experience the suffering we were headed toward farther down the line. Everything God does is good. All things work together for good. And even those negative things, those troublesome things, those sorrowful things, those suffering things, God has a purpose. If we by faith will look for it, we'll see the purpose that's turning us from heading into further trouble. He gave the dream. She said, "I've suffered many things in this day because of a dream because of him." And then look at the precaution she gives, number three. The precaution in verse number 19. "Have thou nothing to do with that just man." There's those two words again. Just man. She's never even really met him. All she's had is a dream from God. But she agrees with Pilate and agrees with Herod and agrees with the centurion later that all say, truly, this is the Son of God. I find no fault in him. And she gives that precaution to her husband. This is just another person declaring his innocence, that he is a just man. She's warning him, don't get involved in this situation. Don't get involved in being anti-Christ. Don't be against him. Don't have anything to do with this just man. Now, she's not saying, don't have anything to do with Christ. That's not what she's saying. She's saying, don't have anything to do. Don't lay your hand. Don't stand in judgment. Don't stretch forth your judgment against this man. Her precaution. Then notice number four, the providence. I like that word. Our old timers, our colonial forefathers, had a strong belief in providence. The providence that brought them across the Atlantic. The providence that directed them to Plymouth Rock instead of down into Virginia where they were originally heading. The providence of God. They even named that town in Rhode Island Providence. They believed in that. We don't use that word too much anymore. It's God's direction. It's God's guidance. It's those circumstances and situations we don't know anything about. And can I tell you this? God's timing is always the best timing. And that's what we're looking at here. Notice the Bible tells us in verse number 19, when he was sat down on the judgment seat, the timing of the dream that Pilate's wife had was right at the right time. It wasn't too late. And it wasn't too early. It wasn't a prophecy. Hey, I had this dream, and a month from now, this man's going to be brought to you. No, it was right there, right at the spur, right when he had said, this man's innocent. I'm going to release him. And the people are crying in uproar, and the wife comes in and said, hey, I had a dream today. Notice she said, this day. I don't know if she took an afternoon nap. I don't know what the thing was there. But she didn't say last night. She said this. God gave her that vision, that dream, right at the right time. If we would be looking for God and His providence, we would see it a lot more. Throughout our day, if we were in constant fellowship and communion with God, we would see Him a lot more. But you know what we do? We categorize God. We put God in a little box. God, I need you here this morning as I start my day and I'm having my devotions. God, I'm communicating with you. Then we go do our thing till lunchtime and we sit down to eat and we bow our head and say, God bless this food. And we then we forget about him until later in the evening. And we put God in little time spots and slots in our life and forget that he's walking with us all the time. And he's watching over us all the time. And we need to look for and appreciate his providence. His timing was perfect. So we've seen the declaration in Luke, the dream in Matthew 27. Now look at the debate, if you would, over in John chapter 18. Again, the four different gospel accounts all telling us of this same event where Jesus stands before Pilate and Pilate gives the Jews a choice. In John chapter 18 and verse number 39, Pilate is going to give the Jews the choice of who they have released to them. John chapter 18 and verse 39, but ye have a custom, Pilate says, that I should release unto you one at the Passover. Will you therefore that I release unto you the King of the Jews? Notice first of all, number one, the practice. He said, you have a custom that I should release unto you one at the Passover. And we don't have a lot of time, but you know basically what the Passover was. It's a celebration of when the Jews were delivered from bondage in Egypt. When they as prisoners were set free. And so that event of Exodus chapter 12, God told them, I want you to observe this Passover every year. And so every year in the month of Abib, which is the month of April, every year the Jews celebrate to this day, celebrate the Passover. When they as prisoners in Egypt were released. And they developed a custom that Pilate was familiar with. Being a ruler in Jerusalem, being familiar with the customs and laws of the Jews, he said, you have a custom that I should release unto you one at the Passover. He's already said, I find no fault in him. And that didn't appease the people. And so now he's going to say, all right, I've got to find another way out of this jam. He's a man in a mess. I'm going to find another way out of this. I'll tell you what, you have a custom at this time of year at the Passover that I release a prisoner to you. One that's a prisoner, he's been declared guilty, everything's fine, but I'll release him. And Pilate, in Pilate's mind, he's saying, the perfect candidate right here in front of me, Christ. I'll release him. Mark chapter 15, verse 6 says about this very same thing. It says that Pilate said, you have a custom I should release unto you one at the Passover, whomsoever they would desire. Whomsoever they would desire. Why is it up to them? Why is it up to them who see, again, his fear of the people. His fear of doing the right thing because of his fear of the wrong crowd. Don't ever fear doing the right thing because of the wrong crowd. And so Pilate says, you have a custom that I should release unto you one at the Passover. Notice number two about this debate. Not only the practice, but notice the proffer. And that's offer, O-F-F-E-R, with a P-R in front of it. And it means an offer made. To proffer something is an offer made. He says, will you therefore that I release unto you the king of the Jews? Pilate's in a tough spot. He's declared Christ innocent. But the crowd has declared him guilty. Now Pilate is grabbing at straws. He's trying to get off the hook. He's trying to find his way out. Instead of manning up, instead of being the judge that he's supposed to be with an innocent man in front of him, trying to appease the people now, he says to them, will you that I release unto you the king of the Jews? Then notice number three, the preference. The preference. And they say in verse number 40, then cried they all again, saying, not this man, but Barabbas. I can just imagine the confusion in Pilate's face. He thought he had himself off the hook again. He thought he found a way out of this predicament. And he says he's chastised Christ, now wants to release him. Surely that'll satisfy him. Who will ye that I should release? And they say Barabbas. Notice what it says at the end of verse 40. Now Barabbas was a robber. They picked a thief over Christ. The other gospel account said that in the insurrection, he had committed murder. In the insurrection, in the rebellion against the Roman government, he had committed murder. He'd murdered someone. That's why he was in prison. And now the Jews are saying, give us the murderer, give us the robber, and take Christ. Isn't it amazing who sinners will choose? Isn't it amazing who their heroes are? The filthiest, the vilest, the wickedest, the most ungodly are the ones that the world elevates. Just get one of those magazines at the grocery store, Us or People or any of that stuff, and look who the heroes are in this world. And they're just wicked people. And that's the way that these Jews were back then. Give us Barabbas. We want Barabbas. You know what Peter said in Acts chapter 3 when he's preaching to those Jews and just laying the hammer down to them? He said, you desired a murderer to be granted unto you. He told those Jews, when you had a choice between your Messiah and Barabbas, you desired a murderer to be given unto you. Folks make bad decisions all the time. Some folks will decide on Sunday morning there's something better than church. Bad decision. Bad decision. They'll decide there's something better on other times other than doing right and serving God. Decide to hang with this crowd instead of the fellowship and that crowd. Wrong decision. Bad decision. We're no different if we're not careful. We're no different from the Jews back then. It's nice to point a finger at them and say, oh, I would have never done that. But people do that all the time now. Choose the wrong one. Choose the wrong direction. Choose the wrong things. His preference. Not this man, but Barabbas. Then notice, if you would, fourthly, letter D, the decision. And that's over in Mark chapter 15. The decision. Mark chapter 15, Pilate now has a political problem. He's got a man on his hands that he's declared innocent, and he can't get him off the hook. He's also got a troubled conscience because his wife has come to him and said, don't have anything to do with this just man. And Pilate, I mean, try to imagine where he's at right now. He's in a mess. He's tried everything he can. He's declared him innocent. He's offered Christ in exchange just to let him go. And everything he's done has failed. Now what's he going to do? In Mark chapter 15 and verse number 12, the Bible says, and Pilate answered and said unto them, what will ye then that I shall do unto him whom ye call the King of the Jews? Notice number one under the decision, the council. The council. And the key word in that verse is, what will ye then that I shall do unto him? Why is he asking them? Boy, wouldn't you love that? If you ever had to go to court, wouldn't you love, you're standing there as being accused and the judge says, what do you think I should do? Oh, well, I think you should let me off the hook. I think you should just forget about everything. Judges don't, that's not how they handle courts. They don't leave it up to the people in the courtroom to decide what the punishment is. Even on a jury trial, they declare innocent or guilty, and the judge still is the one that gives the sentence. But here's Pilate in the midst of this mess, in the midst of all that's going on and how he's troubled and a guilty conscience, and he's just lost all control of everything. He said, what do you want me to do? What will ye then that I shall do unto him? And they answer in verse number 13. And they cried out, crucify him. I don't think our minds can comprehend the awfulness and the tragedy of that situation. The horrendous cry of the Jewish people at that moment in history, being offered Barabbas or Christ, and they say, we want Barabbas, crucify him. That event has shaped the rest of human history. That event dictates the way the world is in 2013. And it's an unbelievable statement, an unbelievable remark. What will you that I do to him? Crucify him. Notice the contesting, number two. The contesting. Pilate says in verse number 14, why? What evil hath he done? You can almost hear the cry in his voice. He wants something. If it's bound to determine that he's going to be crucified, he wants something he can write down to say, here's what he did. And nobody can find anything. Remember it said last week, we locked when Herod was before him, when he said, I find no fault in him. They vehemently accused him, but none of their accusations held up. And now Pilate in desperation says, why? What evil hath he done? There's nothing. He knows it. Herod knows it. Pilate's wife knows it. The Jews know it. Heaven and earth knew it. There was nothing. Nothing justifying his crucifixion. Nothing justifying his treatment in the hands of sinners. But there was just one thing. It was a divine plan for the payment for sin. It was unjust. It wasn't right. It was unlawful. But it happened. Why? What evil hath he done? Number three, the cause. The cause, verse number 15. And I underlined this quite a while back in verse 15 before I ever was studying for this lesson. And so Pilate, these words, willing to content the people. If I could drill something in to your mind, don't ever do anything to content the people. Don't ever compromise to content the people. When you're in a situation between right and wrong, and it's going to be easier to do wrong because it's going to be more popular, do right. It never pays. It never pays to do the wrong thing, even when it's popular. That's why you and I as Christians have a wonderful opportunity to stand in direct opposition to the world we live in. When this world's going in this direction and all of the things that society deals with and all of the immorality and all of the abortion and homosexuality and all that kind of stuff, what a blessing it is to stand over here and say, I'm not going to go along with it. I'm not going to jump on that train. I'm not going to content the people. That's what's popular. That's what everybody's pushing. That's what everybody wants today. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to stand over here. Now, you know what happens when you take that stand. You know what's going to happen. You've got to be willing to be isolated. You've got to be willing to stand on your own. And Pilate wasn't willing to do that. That's the whole problem. He wasn't willing to do that. So Pilate, willing to content the people, he put popularity over principle. We've got to go quickly. Number four, the character. The character, the end of verse 15. He released Barabbas unto them and delivered Jesus when he had scourged him to be crucified. That was his decision. To content the people, he delivered Barabbas and scourged Jesus and delivered him to be crucified. Number five, the ceremony. And this is found again over in Matthew's account in chapter 27 and verse 24. The Bible says that Pilate took water and washed his hands. Now, there's an old Jewish custom back in the book of Deuteronomy. Remember those cities of refuge? All that stuff that happened? If someone died, if someone was killed, and it was with proximity of a certain town, but nobody knew who had killed that person, the dead person lay there, they checked it out, they couldn't find it, the elders of that city would wash their hands ceremonially, wash their hands in water, declaring, we've researched it, we've checked it out, we've looked for everything we can't find the guilty person, and so they would wash their hands in water. David said over in Psalm chapter 26 and verse 6, I will wash my hands in innocency. Pilate's trying to imitate that, but it isn't going to fly. He sits down there and washes his hands in water as if him declaring Christ, oh, I'm putting it on you. This is all about you. You've declared it. I have nothing to do with it. He washes his hands. Then number six, the curse. The curse. And the Jews cried out, His blood be upon us and our children. Again, if in our minds we could go back and picture this whole mob scene and imagine these Jews back there crying out, His blood be upon us, not knowing that 40 years from that very date, 40 years, Nero's going to come down into Jerusalem and not leave one stone upon another and slay a million people, a million Jews. People say, well, it's because he's anti-Semitic. Well, that's true. But you know why it was? Because they said, the curse be upon us and our children. 1,900 years later, Hitler would put a bunch of Jews into a concentration camp. Was it justified? No. Was it right to do? Absolutely not. But you know what it was? His blood be upon us and our children. Better be careful. Better be careful when we can't wash our hands in innocency when we're guilty. You can't get off the hook when you're doing what's wrong. It's going to come back. The Bible says sometimes it's the third and fourth generation. So we learn the terrible circumstances involved with the choice. Let's go to the Lord in prayer. Father, help us to make right choices, right decisions, to honor you, glorify you, serve you, stand for you in the midst of this.